Thank you all for sharing tonight with us. I'd like to introduce Ajahn Brahm. I believe all of you are here because you know him, and if you don't know, I shall just briefly read his bio. So Ajahn Brahm is known to open the door of many of our hearts, written several books like Good, Bad, Who Knows, and Opening the Door of Your Heart, which is also the first book I read and started learning about Buddhism. So he was born in UK and studied theoretical physics at Cambridge University. After he graduated in his early adult years, he traveled to Thailand to train with Venerable Ajahn Chah. And after that, practicing for 9 years as a monk, he was sent to Perth by Ajahn Chah in 1983 and was soon invited to provide his humorous and uplifting teachings in other parts of Australia and the rest of the world. But such recognition has not stopped him from dedicating his time to the sick, those in prison, his own Sangha members at Bodhiana Monastery in Perth, and of course, Buddhist Fellowship Singapore. Ajahn is also our spiritual patron at Buddhist Fellowship Singapore, and he has hundreds of Dharma talks available online, which many of them are downloaded every single day. So we are really fortunate to have him tonight. Without further ado, shall we put our palms together and welcome Ajahn Brahm on stage.
Okay, so that today's talk is supposed to be on the heart of happiness. Did I get that right? Is that good enough? Okay, very good. But first of all, just a few weeks ago, we celebrated the Chinese New Year. And many people, even in Australia, were wishing me a happy New Year. And I said, no, I am not going to do what you tell me to do. I'm going to have a happy New Year if I want, and I reserve my right to have a miserable New Year if that's what I want too. Because one of the problems is people are always telling us to be happy. And sometimes if you don't feel happy, that makes you even worse. It is just like when we wish to go and see somebody in a hospital. And we say, oh, I hope you get better. I hope your sickness doesn't last. Imagine what it feels like if you're feeling really, really sick and all these people are trying to make you feel better, which means you start lying. When so many people go to so much effort to visit you and they sacrifice so much time to come to the hospital by your bedside, and they ask you, are you feeling better today? And even if you feel miserable, if you feel terrible, you always lie and say, well, I feel a tiny bit better today. Just because you don't want to upset people. So when I visit people in hospital, I never say, I hope you get better. I say, you can get better or you can get worse, it's up to you. But whichever way, I will still love you. And that frees people. Because sometimes people try so hard to get better because they feel that being sick is a huge mistake in life, as if they've done something terribly wrong, as if they're a failure because they've got sick, and because they're not allowed to be sick, they try so hard to get better that makes them sick. There's a classic story of one of my friends. We were months together in the jungles of Thailand many years ago. And even though he was a Rhodes Scholar from Oxford, and even I was from Cambridge, I did forgive him for going to Oxford. But we were better friends. But unfortunately, he got typhoid fever, two types of typhoid fever at the same time, and he never really recovered. So he was sent to our monastery in UK because we thought he would get better treatment there. And I remember visiting him, and he had been bedridden for about 2 years, never been able to go out of the room because he was so weak. And even though the supporters got the very best doctors, both the usual types of medical doctors, alternative doctors, Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, homeopathic medicine, Reiki, acupuncture, you name it, he had it. But nothing worked. He was getting more and more sick. Until one of the monks came to see him. And imagine you've been sick for 2 years, 3 years, and never being able to show any possibility of any type of recovery. Just bedridden. Not really healthy, but not dying. So, this monk came up there and told him, said, I've come up here on behalf of all the people who love you and care for you. Your fellow monastics, the supporters, your family. On behalf of everybody, I've come up here to give you permission to die. You can die if you want to. You don't have to try and get better. And at that, this Rhodes Scholar, who was a champion wrestler, because to get a Rhodes Scholarship in Oxford, you also had to have some sporting achievements as well as your academic achievements. And that was, he was a champion wrestler as well as being a very bright man. And now, even though he's a champion wrestler, he was given permission to die. And he cried. He wept. And from that time on, he started to get better. And he's alive even today in South Africa. He writes to me every now and again. He was trying so hard to get better, it was making him sick. So, if ever you go to see your relations in hospital, don't put the pressure on them to get better, because trying to get better, the stress of trying to get better, and the feeling of failure that you are sick in the first place, that might actually kill them. So tell them, you know, Grandma, Granddad, I will love you, you'll be my friend no matter what happens. But I will tell you a story which I've been telling people in Hong Kong. Somehow or other they thought it very funny, because I was talking about some of the mistakes I make in my life as a monk, and it was only recently that when I went to go and visit a Buddhist family, whose father, grandfather was in the ICU in a Perth hospital, and they wanted me to go and do some chanting for him. And I'm very happy to go and spend time helping out Buddhist families and do some chanting. It was a Chinese family. I don't know if it was from Malaysia or Singapore. But anyway, I went into the ICU, and I have got some very powerful chanting. I could really get the energies going and zap them with my chanting. So I zapped him. And it worked. He got better. From the ICU on the edge of death, he recovered. And after he recovered, the family were very, very angry at me. Ajahn Brahm, what have you done? Well, he's better. He's going to live for a few more years. But Ajahn Brahm, that's not what we wanted. We'd already arranged the funeral. All the relations had come in from overseas. And we prepared for his death. And now we have to do it all over again because of you. So these days, I always, whenever I go to chant for someone in a hospital, please, tell me what type of chanting you want. the chanting to give them a peaceful death, or the chanting for them to get better. How would I know what to do? So anyway, sometimes you do make little mistakes like that, but you laugh at it. But even with sickness and being happy, sickness is just one example of what I'm coming to in this talk about the heart of happiness. Why is it There's a few doctors, I know a few of the GPs here. Why is it when somebody comes to your surgery, do they come up to you and say, "Doctor, there is something wrong with me, I'm sick"? Straight away you should see what the problem is there. Because they say, "There is something wrong with me, I'm sick." There is nothing wrong with being sick, and I will now prove it to you. There's a huge number of people in this hall. Would you kindly put your hand up if you have never been sick in your life? Never once sick in your life. There's only one person. I think that must be an older person who's got a bit of dementia and forgotten some of the things that happened earlier. Everybody has been sick. In fact, now if a person has never ever been sick in their life, you would be a medical miracle. People would take you into the universities and medical centers. They would do experiments on you. You are weird. You are strange. There's something not quite right with you because you're always healthy. So this is proving there is nothing wrong with being sick. So please change your speech and make it more truthful. The next time you go to see your doctor with dengue fever, with cancer, with MERS or SARS or Zika, whatever is the current sickness of the month, the one which is in fashion. Whatever it is, you should go to your doctor and say, "Doctor, there is something right with me. I'm sick again." Now seriously, if you change your attitude, you say, "There's something right with me, I am sick." Number one, you would probably go to see your doctor much earlier when you have any problems with your body. Because we say there's something wrong with me, we stigmatize sickness, we think that it's a personal failure, which means that we don't admit there's something wrong with us, and by the time we go and see that doctor, it's a little bit too late. So stop stigmatizing sickness. It's okay to be sick. There's not something wrong that you are sick. It's right that you are sick. It's part of life. And it's the same with like happiness. People always feel that if they're miserable, there's something wrong with them, and they should somehow fix it up. Not being happy is part of life. For those of you who've managed to see the Good, Bad, Who Knows book, to see it in its American edition, you will see it's got another title. Whichever place that that book is published, it always has different titles, and there's a meaning for that. It means that sometimes you think, "Oh, this is a new book by Ajahn Brahm," and you buy it and you don't realize it's only the title has changed, the contents are the same. That way I get more books sold. It is wonderful marketing. But that particular book in America is called Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. And the reason we put it like that is because in the United States many years ago, there were even billboards going around, "Don't worry, be happy," it used to say. And this was a revolt against trying to force people to be happy when they don't feel like it. America is a free country. The American Constitution guarantees the right to pursue happiness or misery, whichever you like. It is your right and freedom to be miserable and grumpy. So if you are grumpy, don't worry about it. Just enjoy it. Accept it. Because there was a very key story in this talk about a young lady who just happened to be Indonesian. There's many Indonesians here tonight, Selamat Malam. And she was on one of my meditation retreats and she was having a terrible time. Everyone else was smiling and getting into deep meditations and being very happy, but she felt miserable. And whenever I told her in the talks how to be happy, that made her feel even more of a failure, because she didn't feel happy at all. And her being upset, her misery got worse and worse. She was very close to being depressed. So I had to do something about that. How can you deal with someone who's not happy at all and getting depressed? So I told her, sit down here. I'm going in my office. I'm going to get a little certificate for you. And I very quickly printed out the very first grumpy license that I have issued in this world. I've issued thousands since that time. And it was very well written in Gothic script with a letterhead at the top, just like a driving license or a marriage certificate, or more likely a degree which you get from a prominent university, which gives you this accreditation so you can go off into life and get work. So this was a certificate which I issued. I was her teacher. I had authority to issue this certificate. And she trusted me. But it wasn't the certificate which she expected. It was a grumpy license. This certificate grants to Veronica, her name was, permission to be miserable at any time, for any reason or no reason whatsoever, signed. And I did my full title. If you don't know what my full title is, it's H.R. Ajahn Brahm. H.R. stood for His Roundness, Ajahn Brahm. And I signed it and dated it and gave it to her. And it was a wonderful effect it had. Now she had permission to be miserable. Now she could be at peace with being miserable. She became happy. When people try to be happy, they get very miserable. When they try to be healthy, a lot of times you get very sick. Stress. So the secret of happiness is learning how to be miserable. If that's what you feel today, allowing yourself to be who you are. And of course, you all know one of the most important stories, you know, in my books, the story which gave the title to the first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. That is one of the best secrets of what happiness truly is and what it means. A lot of times, Buddhists, we always think we know about compassion and loving kindness. I don't know if you, when I was in Hong Kong last week, I saw the news in the hotel room of Hillary Clinton in her speech. And I don't know if you noticed this, but Hillary Clinton was starting to talk about there should be more loving kindness in America. And my ears picked up, that's a Buddhist word, loving kindness. You don't see that from, you know, the American literary tradition. She somehow or other has been exposed to Buddhism because that's the word she mentioned, loving kindness. And it reminded me that when I heard a recording of Aung San Suu Kyi's a Nobel Prize winner speech, not the one which her son gave when she was in house arrest, but the one which she gave when she was free to go to a ceremony belatedly to receive her Nobel Peace Prize. And she started mentioning we should open the door of our heart. to the military. Nothing. I wonder where she got that one from. Some of these words and phrases, they just go the rounds and they actually work. So opening the door of your heart, loving kindness, people think they know what loving kindness is, and even many of you, you may do your chanting. May all beings be happy and well. May they be free of suffering. That is not loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. Perhaps they have something to learn from being sick, from struggling. Maybe the suffering of life has a purpose and we should not take it away. You all remember, just because of the advances in the understanding of human health, if we don't allow our children, when they're young, to get this little sickness and that little flu, they don't actually develop their immune system. If we protect our children from dirt and scratches, they grow up being very weak. And so that sometimes we think we're protecting people, but we're actually harming them. And sometimes when we understand sickness and also a little bit of suffering in life, sometimes that suffering in life can be a huge opportunity for great wisdom. So I'm not going to go around wishing everybody be happy and well, because then you'll never learn anything in life. So real happiness actually comes from this wonderful saying of opening the door of your heart to whatever happens in life. The door of my heart is open to dengue, to people dying, to sickness, for disappointment. We're open to the times in our life when it looks like things are going wrong. The door of our heart is open to all of these things. Now that actually changes the whole idea of what happiness truly is and what the heart is. It's very easy to love life when it goes according to plan. But how many of us can actually learn how to be happy, to open the door of our heart, no matter what happens in life? Even when someone becomes sick, or when there's a failure, when you lose money on the stock market, or like recently in my own monastery in Australia, we were robbed. A burglar came into my monastery and stole a lot of expensive tools from our workshop. Was I unhappy? No! I opened the door of... Actually, someone opened the door of the workshop for the burglar. But I opened the door of my heart to him. I don't know who that burglar was, but I hope he was very happy taking our chainsaws and our generators and many other expensive tools. And straight away when I first found out, I said, well, people can steal your goods, but they can't steal your happiness unless you let them. They can steal your reputation by criticizing you, but they don't need to steal your happiness. Life can steal your health, but it doesn't need to steal your happiness. Life can steal your parents into death, but it doesn't need to steal your happiness, because that secret of happiness is realizing that you have to open the door of your heart to life, the way of our world, gain and loss sometimes, sickness and death, but we have a different attitude. First of all, there's nothing wrong with being sick, so I never even say that. There's something right with me, I'm sick again, and there's something right. Somebody stole things from our monastery. But look at it in a positive way. In fact, it turned out to be a wonderful thing for our monastery in Australia, because what that thief stole were old chainsaws and old generators and old tools. And the insurance company paid out on full for all that was insured. So with the insurance money, we got new generators, new chainsaws, much better models. And so after it was all settled, we were ahead. And the burglar was ahead. It was a win-win situation for us. So if ever I could find that burglar, I would actually say thank you so much. You made a lot of good karma by allowing our monastery to improve our tools. And now, of course, you can see what I'm saying there. Instead of allowing life, sickness, losing things, to take away your happiness, that is not happiness. Just getting what you want and being healthy and not losing stuff and not having arguments. Now, I always say that when I was young, I was from a very poor family. We were poor, legitimately poor. If you want to know a serious story, this is a bit emotional for me because when I say this, I remember my parents. In a small little apartment owned by the local government, it was called Council Flat, above the coal fire, which is the only thing you could use to keep warm in the cold winter days of London. Someone, I don't know whether it was my mother or father, left a £1 banknote on the shelf above the fire. It was perfectly safe, they thought. And then a breeze came from no one knew where, lifted up the banknote, and it fell into the fire. And my father tried to rescue that £1 note and burnt his hand, while my mother wept. She cried, because that was such a big amount of money for them. And to see it needlessly just fall into the fire and be burnt. When my father risked a serious burn, it wasn't that bad, fortunately, and my mother just cried. We were very poor. But that had many advantages, because I realized, I often saw my parents arguing. And sometimes they argued so much that they wouldn't speak to each other. So my father would say, tell your mum, and my mother would say, tell your father. And then he would say, what did she say? And I'd say, what did he... You know what it's like sometimes. But it would not last that long. Soon it came after a couple of hours or 3 hours at most that they made up, they forgave each other. And I learned something really important from seeing that it is natural to have arguments. It is part of life to have differences of opinions. But it's also part of life to have reconciliation. And that reconciliation was such a beautiful part of life. So I was happy to understand that arguments are part of life. We do have differences of opinion. And we will stand our ground. But there always comes a time when, if we have enough wisdom about what's most important in life, what is most important in life? Being right or being in love? Okay, here's one of my old stories I haven't said for a long time here in Singapore. I always say this at a marriage ceremony. There was a couple who had just been married, and one afternoon after lunch they were having a walk in the park. And as they were walking in the park, they heard a sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And straight away the girl said, oh darling, can you hear that? That is a chicken. And he replied, a chicken? That can't be a chicken. That must be a duck. It went quack, quack. It's a duck. And it went quack, quack again. That's a duck, darling. She said, no way, that is a chicken. She said, it can't be. He said, it can't be a chicken, it's a duck. She said, I am sure it's a chicken, believe me. No, I will not believe you, that is a duck. No, it's a chicken. No, it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. It is a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. And she said, the chicken. And she was about to burst into tears. when he remembered what is most important in a marriage. He remembered why he married her. He looked into her eyes, which were about to burst into water, squeezed her hand, and said, "Darling, I think you may be right. There is a chicken." And it went quack, quack again. And she said, "Thank you, darling." And that night, he got a hot meal. Now, in that story, it is a story of happiness in a marriage. Who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that important? Honestly. But how many of you argue over those silly things? Small things. It's not important. What's more important is harmony. And so many marriages, they just split apart over small things, arguing over things you should never argue over. And anyway, number two, just because it goes quack, quack does not mean it's a duck. Sometimes people think they're logical, but they're not scientific. I was trained in Cambridge, theoretical physics. I know my science. It just because it goes quack, quack does not mean it's a duck. That could have been a chicken from Fukushima Prefecture in Japan. Apparently they had the 5th anniversary today, or a couple of days ago. A mutant chicken who goes quack, quack. So, give it the benefit of the doubt. It doesn't matter who's right, who's wrong, but what is beautiful, yeah, you do have those arguments, but that reconciliation, that is where we see the secret of happiness. The heart of happiness, which knows priorities, what is most important and what is least important. Being right is not that important. Being kind, being compassionate, being in love, that is more important. But that's what I learned by living in a small house, seeing these things. But I was saying, I just came back from Hong Kong. You know, some of the best teachings I ever learned in Cambridge was not at the university. Because I was a Buddhist when I first went to Cambridge. I was a Buddhist a couple of years beforehand. I decided to read books to find out which religion I liked. I called it market research. So I chose books on all different types of religions and eventually chose Buddhism. That was the one which fitted me. And later on, when I was at Cambridge, obviously I didn't have many friends who were Buddhists. Some of my friends were Christians, very active Christians. And when some of my friends who were Christians told me they were volunteering to do some community service in a local hospital for the mentally infirm, I took that as a challenge. If the Christians could do it, the Buddhists can do it as well. It was totally keeping up with the Joneses, spiritual pride, which drove me to go to this place. I would never be outdone, out-prayed, out-meditated, out-taught by those Christians. That's what I was like in those days. So, just out of trying to keep up with my friends, I went there too, but quite honestly, truthfully, those Christians only lasted a couple of weeks. I went to this hospital for 2 years, every Thursday afternoon. And I was helping look after people with Down's syndrome. And it was a weird experience that I looked forward to going to that unit. These were my friends. At the time, I didn't realize how much I learned being with people whose language skills were very, very weak, but whose emotional wisdom was incredible. Remember, I was in colleges where you could sit next to Nobel laureates and have dinner with them. I would have bumped into Stephen Hawkins for sure, because we hang out in the same facility, the Department of Applied Maths and Theoretical Physics. Only he wasn't in a wheelchair there, and yet not famous. He would have also bumped into me, but wouldn't have recognized me because I wasn't famous yet. But all those people I met who were brilliant in their fields, great philosophers, great professors, they were missing something which I could see in those people who had Down syndrome, the emotional wisdom. And this is an example of this. Now, I was a young man, not born a monk. I had girlfriends. I liked going out at night. And there were times, and I couldn't understand where they could get this from. I had just broken up with a girlfriend the night before. They split up, boys and girls, that's what happens. And you feel quite miserable. And those people would see me and come running towards me and just give me a hug. And they knew that there was some big emotional problem in my life. They could see that, where other people could not. I learned from them whatever I know these days of emotional wisdom, of how this thing inside our head actually works. And that emotional wisdom, that heart, that becomes the secret of happiness. Yeah, they were not successful in life. They would never become Nobel laureates. But they had a certain amount of joy and happiness and simplicity just in their general way of behaving towards one another, and especially me, which I really, really respected. And I would have learned from them for 2 years. One of the best things I ever did when I was at university. But it also meant you understood just how a person can have happiness even though they're sick, even though they don't have much, even though the things go wrong in their life. There's a certain amount of embracing this life, opening the door of your heart to it, and realizing that everything which ever happens to us in life is an opportunity for the great teaching. Many of you will have lots of pain in your life. Disappointments. Things go wrong in your life. It happens to me a lot. Sometimes I tell a joke and people don't get it. Or it's a joke they've heard before. Or, for example, I told people the other day about the joke of the four priests, Catholic priests, and I got into trouble because there were some Catholics in the audience. But it's still a very good joke, and here it comes. There were four Catholic priests, they'd just been to a conference, and at lunchtime they're at the same table, and they were talking with one another. And they'd just been to a session on confessions. Letting people know your darkest secrets. Because psychologically, emotionally, it's really worthwhile sharing them with another person. And so one of those priests decided it was a time that he made his confession. So he said to his three friends, "This is very difficult and shameful for me to say, but," he said, "I have an addiction to gambling. I gamble on the horse racing, on the soccer, I gamble on anything, and I've wasted so much money belonging to the church on gambling, but I just can't stop myself. I know it's a terrible sin, but I'm a terrible gambler." And the other members of the clergy were really shocked. A person in your position who leads a community and tries to set a good example to others, and you spend all the money gambling, that is terrible. But they said, "It's good you let us know. And then they turned to the second priest and said, "What about you?" He said, "Oh, crikey, I suppose I'd better confess." And he said, "I'm an alcoholic. Any wine which is left from the Mass, I drink it all up. And then I go up buying bottles of whiskey and gin and anything. And usually on a Sunday evening after all the service is over, I get plastered. No one knows me because I hide in my room. And also Monday the same. I'm an alcoholic. I've got a big drinking problem." And they were shocked. He'd hidden it so well. A man of your stature could do things like that. That's terrible. But at least it's good you tell us. And then they looked at the third priest and he didn't want to say anything, but they eventually got it out of him. And that was one of the big sins. Adultery. One of the married women in his congregation he was having an illicit affair with. And the other four was, the other three were stunned. A person in your position. You tell other people to keep their precepts and rules and you're breaking it yourself. "But I love her." "Yes, but you should never do that. That's really bad." And then they asked the fourth priest. And the fourth priest said, "Please, don't ask me." And they said, "But you must tell us." He said, "I can't. You don't want to hear it. Believe me." He said, "No, it can't be anything worse than gambling, drinking, and womanizing." He said, "It's much worse. It's much worse." And what do you think it could have been for a priest? Worse than gambling, worse than being an alcoholic, worse, much worse than adultery. Eventually they got it out of him. He said, "My worst sin, I cannot keep a secret. I'm a terrible gossip." But they chased him. That's interesting. Sometimes when I give that little story when I talk about speech. Yeah, lying is bad. So criticizing and being harsh to other people is bad. But the worst of the wrong speeches is gossiping, because that hurts more than anything else. But anyway, sometimes I tell a joke and say, "Well, that's part of it." Because I open the door of my heart to that. Because when you allow things to happen, yeah, you make a mistake. Yeah, you're grumpy. You don't feel so well. You get sick. There's nothing wrong with that. The secret of happiness is opening the door of your heart to life. And when we open the door of our heart to life, it's amazing just how our happiness increases enormously. It's a different type of happiness. It's not the happiness always that things have to go right in your life. You always have to be successful. You're allowed to fail, and it's called forward failing when you make a mistake. You're allowed to get to fall into the dog shit. And it's called fertilizer. It actually makes the life richer when you have big mistakes in life. You're allowed for things to go wrong because there you really learn. People who are poor, who are hungry, will learn what it's like not to have enough food, and you will never ever pass by someone who is hungry once you've known what it feels like. People have been down and out. You've lost all your money. Someone has cheated you. Later on, when you get on your feet, you'll never pass by somebody else who's in that situation without helping them. You have had cancer and you've got through it. You will go and volunteer to help other people with that terrible disease because you know what it's like. Sometimes the things which happen to us in our life, yeah, they're very difficult when it happens, but it is from that which we learn. That's where we grow. That is where we get our wisdom from. Some of my best teachers in school were the strictest ones, the ones I didn't like. They pushed me And I learned so much from that. So I learned that all the difficulties and problems in life, I accept them. There was a beautiful old story I said many years ago, because it does happen that sometimes people lose their children. They die. And for some people, that's one of the most difficult things for them to accept. A young kid, because I say this, because when I was in Hong Kong, I gave a talk at the Chinese University in Hong Kong. Was it? Yeah, it was last night. And I was invited to give the talk there because there was many suicides. And the latest one was a 12-year-old boy jumped off a building, 12 years of age, killed himself. And they wanted to know why and how to deal with that. Sometimes children do die. And they always ask the question, why? Why do young kids have to get cancer when they haven't had hardly any life at all? Why do even babies 3 or 4 years of age get terrible diseases and there's no cure for them? Why? And this is where the wisdom comes from, which allows you to understand the laws of this world, to be at peace with them, embrace them, and find a happiness which you may not recognize. Call it a sweet and sour happiness. It was the story I heard from an old monk in the north of Thailand. He said that once he was staying in a simple bamboo and thatched hut in the middle of the jungle, when one evening there was a very fierce storm. The winds were very strong, so fierce that many big branches came off the trees, and many trees themselves were uprooted and came crashing down to the floor. I must always do some dramatic speech during my talks to keep people awake. They came crashing down to the floor, and when they came crashing down to the floor, he realized that if one of those trees or big branches would actually hit his hut, it would kill him. It was only bamboo and thatch, no protection at all. It would go straight through the roof, and if it didn't actually kill him there and then, he would get so badly injured. There was no smartphones in those days. There's no way of alerting anybody. You'd be injured in that hut and have a slow death instead of a fast death if you were crushed. It's really dangerous. But he survived, obviously, because he could tell me the story. That's one of the reasons. You know, there were tigers in Thailand at that time. You know, that other month, when I went off into the jungles by myself, and I knew there were tigers there, I asked, is it safe? And they said, no. Tigers would never eat a monk. That's what they told me. I said, how do you know? There is no recorded tale of a tiger ever eating a monk. I said, there wouldn't be, would there? They'd have eaten a monk and he couldn't tell you. So it didn't really. When was the last time I told you about my tiger story? You know, I lived in the jungles for years and I actually came face to face with a tiger once. Huge animal. And it was only maybe just the other side of that table away from me. Huge animal. And it's amazing, sometimes you don't know what your reaction will be. There you were, about 3 foot away from a tiger, a big tiger. And I was only a peaceful monk. Only that distance, and I was not scared. Honestly, there was no fear in me at all. Was that really impressive? It wasn't really impressive, because there were these huge, thick iron bars between me and that tiger, because I was visiting the zoo. And you jump to conclusions, you think it was in the jungle, it was in the zoo. There were bars between me. It was only that far away. I wasn't afraid at all. But anyway, so this monk in a jungle, he survived, and he told me afterwards the most fascinating part of this story. He went outside after the storm to look at the damage, as you would do. And many trees had just missed his hut. He was very lucky to survive. But then what took his attention was not the trees or the branches which lay on the forest floor. What he looked at were the leaves. The leaves which lay dead on the forest floor, torn off the tree by the storm, were mostly the old brown leaves. But amongst those brown leaves, there were many yellow leaves as well. Amongst the yellow leaves, some green leaves. Only a few, but there were some there. And amongst those green leaves, there were some leaves which were so freshly green, so bright, he knew they could have only come forth from the bud the day before. Young leaves, baby leaves, they were lying dead on the forest floor. And he looked up to see what leaves were left, and of course, mostly green leaves. But even though some young green leaves had been torn off the twigs and branches, there were still many yellow leaves and even a few old brown leaves still clinging on to the tree of life, even though young green leaves had been torn off. He realized an important insight, wisdom. When the storms of disease and death come through our communities, they usually take the old brown leaves and yellow leaves, but they also always take a few green leaves as well, and young green leaves. It's part of nature. There's nothing which has gone wrong. This is our life, our world. Young people die, and you cannot say something has gone wrong. Now you understand why. Nature. And the only way to have happiness, to have peace, is open the door of your heart to that nature. And of course, the last little story I'm going to say before opening it up for Q&A. Again, I find this one of the most helpful stories, which is how we can be happy and open up our heart, the heart of happiness, where we allow ourselves to be wise to the nature of life. I started off with sickness. Now I'm going to go to death. Because so many people in our world, they get so upset and grief-stricken when somebody dies. And I've told you before that my own father died when I was only 16. He died in our little apartment. My mother woke me in the middle of the night, saying, "I cannot wake up your father." So I went into his bedroom and tried shaking him. He was cold, he was stiff, he was dead. But I loved that man very much. I told many stories to you over the years about him. But I never cried at his funeral service. And I've never shed a tear since. I knew that was weird, that was strange, there was something abnormal. Because children, especially when you love your parents, feel very, very grief-stricken when they die. I had no grief at all. And it took me many years, especially being a monk, when you have time to understand your emotions and you have the teachings of people with Down syndrome to inspire you to feel rather than think. So I soon figured out what was happening. And that's where I came up with the simile of the concert, which is, I found, a very moving simile. I loved going to concerts when I was a young man. I went to many, many amazing concerts, classical concerts in the Albert Hall, rock concerts, some of the best bands in the world I saw. I always love telling you the story that my brother and I went to this pub in the north of London to see a band play, and only six people turned up to listen. Only six. My brother and I were two of those six. The lead singer was called Rod Stewart. Private concert with Rod in the 60s. So I had some wonderful memories of those great concerts. But I also remembered at the end of the concert, we'd all clap and shout for more. It was called the encore. But when the encore was finished, that's when the band had to go home, and so did I. Sure, there'll be another concert next week. Sure, maybe even that band will come back again. Apparently they still come back again. The Rolling Stones are still touring around, even though they're geriatric. What's they called? They're called the Strolling Bones. Really old. But nevertheless, they still manage to perform. I never thought they'd get on that long. So, I think pop musicians, people like the Rolling Stones, they're not allowed to retire, just like monks. We're not allowed to retire either. But anyway, after that concert was over, the encore had finished, and I had to go out of the concert hall. You knew that you would never ever hear that music again. Even if they did perform 2 or 3 years later, it would be different. The energy, the originality, it would not be there anymore. So this was this incredible concert you'd just been to. And when I walked out of that concert hall, and it was always into the cold London night, always raining, always cold, always miserable, never once, not once did I cry at the end of a concert, even though I knew it was over. What I felt was this wonderful sense of joy and gratitude. How lucky I was to have been there for this amazing performance. And that was how I felt when my father died. That's how I felt when I walked out of the crematorium. It was the end of one of the great performances of my life, my father's. And I felt how lucky and blessed I was to have been with him, to have been loved and to have given love. And just like those concerts in the 60s, I still remember them. Still, I don't know, people my age. I remember Jefferson Airplane giving a free concert and just saying, "Just you English are amazing. You just, it rains and you still listen to us in California. Any rain, they want to go home." That was Grace Slick said that, I remember. So many great memories. I remember that stuff even though it was 40, 50 years ago. And I remember what my father did, the times we had together, even though that was such a long time ago. Great music never dies. Musicians, they go away, but the music lingers. Your loved ones die, they pass on, but your memories, the music, those sweet, sweet, sweet times of love and fun, that never disappears. That's why I never cry. I understand you have to accept life and death. It's part of this existence. And to be happy is to open the door of your heart to life as it is. And there you find you have all the happiness in the world. You don't tell people, "Oh, may you never die. Oh, may you never get sick. Oh, may you never have any arguments in a marriage. Oh, may all children live to maturity. Oh, may all governments tell the truth. Oh, may all aircraft not get lost in the ocean. Oh, may the stock market always go up and never go down. Oh, may my boss always be kind to me." Get real. And when you are real and accept this life, there you will find happiness. When you fight life, when you ask from life what it can never give you, that is called suffering. When you understand life and you enjoy it, even the difficult times, see it in a different way, then you will always have whatever happiness, however much happiness you ever need. Thank you all for listening. Very good. So now we have the interrogation time, where you can ask your question about anything.
Thank you so much, Ajahn Brahm. So there will be papers that's being passed around. If you have any questions, you can fill them out. Just raise your hands to the volunteers in yellow. Or you can log on to our Facebook page, and under the message tab, just private message us. And Brother Chai and Brother Chong Jin will also communicate. We have about 45 minutes for Q&A. So if there are too many questions, we might need to be a little bit more selective. So hope to seek your forgiveness. As we're waiting for questions, may I just get permission to kneel beside Ajahn?
Very good.
I'll be here. Let me start off with a question. So I really like how your stories teach us that it's okay to be sick, it's okay to age, it's okay to die. And I think sometimes, you know, actually we all die. And it's only a doctor has a judgment to say, hey, you only have 2 months left, and then we start thinking about dying. But actually each and every one of us are dying. But it's okay because it's part and parcel of life, and it's okay to embrace it. So how would you advise people who think, okay, it's okay to die, and it's probably a good way to end off life and to solve all the sufferings in life? How would you advise them?
Okay, you're talking about people who get really depressed. They think that death is an escape from life. This is obviously not a very wise thing to do, because especially as Buddhists we believe in reincarnation. So once you've killed yourself, you're back there again. It was even more depressing. You were depressed before you killed yourself, thinking you're going to disappear, and now you're back again. You'd be doubly depressed. It didn't work. So that's not a good thing to do. But if a person wants some escape, you don't escape by running away from things. You escape from understanding things, for investigating, getting to know it. And then you find things like depression. They are just some things, they come and they go. Two big stories, this too will pass. Now, that story is in the book, you've heard it before, the Emperor's Ring story, an emperor who got very depressed when things went wrong in the economy, when the Chinese economy went down, the emperor got really depressed, like now. When commodity prices went up, spent too much, that's like the Australian government. And both cases are stupid. It will pass. The good times will pass, the bad times will pass. And the person who understands that means that, yeah, it's a difficult time, it doesn't last. But more importantly, with that story, when the good times are there, when you're having a wonderful time with your family, with your kids, the business is going well, for goodness sake, don't take it for granted. It's temporary. So you have to look after that. So that's one of those stories, you know, that it will pass. The other one is the two bad bricks in the wall, that people just see the bad bricks, they don't see anything else in the wall, so they want to blow up the wall like I used to do, I wanted to do. So it's not escape. And the whole idea of escaping is the old story I told yesterday to a group of professors in the medical school of Prince Wales Hospital in Hong Kong, in Sha Tin. There, a lot of professors were really, actually one was crying, confession of medicine, I brought him to tears. And it was because I was telling him about, as a doctor, your job is not to cure people. That is not your main aim in life. Your main aim in life is not to cure, but to care. To care for those patients, not to cure them. So if you think curing, getting rid of the problem, then you've missed the point, and you will fail many, many times. But if your job is to care, not to cure, then you never need to be a failure, and also your client's health will improve enormously, because care is really important. That's the same with end of life, disappointments. You don't cure the problem by killing yourself. The whole idea of curing it is wrong. You care for it. You care for it. You learn from it. Because every problem, every piece of shit, as I keep saying, is fertilizer for your wisdom and compassion. You don't get rid of it. That's trying to cure it. You care for it. And you become a better human being as a result. Now you've got lots of questions here, so now I'll have to answer them very quickly.
Thank you so much, Ajahn. So there is a question on dealing with suffering, because you mentioned that it's okay to be angry. So there is this lady over here who said, "Dear Ajahn, why is my daughter running away from relatives? She dislikes foreigners around Singapore too. Is she suffering from some form of abnormality?"
Yeah, I'm suffering because I couldn't hear the question very well. How is the audio here? Can you hear well? Yeah. What was the question again? I'll get to it. Have a look. In English or Chinese? My daughter is running away from relatives, dislikes foreigners around Singapore too. She's suffering from some sort of abnormality. But I don't know how old your daughter is, but sometimes the daughter does those things with relatives, dislikes foreigners around. I don't know what she's up to. Very hard to say. But it will pass. If she sees a very, very hot foreigner, she'll probably go up to him and say hello. And if she's got very nice relatives, especially at Chinese New Year when there's lots of ang paos around, she'll be probably very happy to go to see her relatives. So I don't know what's going on with her, but maybe have a chat with her, see what's going on. At least she's your daughter and she doesn't run away from you. And just give her a bit of kindness. She may be going through some stuff in her life. We all go through stuff in our life. We dislike somebody one day and then we like them the next day. That's life. So just probably leave her alone. A bit of TLC, she'll be okay.
All right. Thank you, Ajahn. So a follow-up question on dealing with loved ones. How do you manage when you see your loved ones suffer in pain due to old age?
Okay. How do you react when you see your loved one suffer with pain in old age? Remember that if you react to her pain, you make it worse. I remember one time I stepped on a nail and it almost went right through my foot. It didn't hurt me at the time, but another mum with me looked at her and said, "Wow, look at that, that must hurt." And as soon as he said that, it started to hurt. So if you're relative is suffering in pain, don't say, "Oh, that must be terrible. Oh, that must be awful." Try and change it around, saying, "Oh, you're so lucky having so much pain." Because in many traditions, oh, they get so much wisdom from pain. Maybe you're exhausting all your bad karma in this life, so you're getting over now so you can go to heaven. Whatever it is, you can even bend the truth. I was going to say lie, but I shouldn't ask you to lie. Whatever it is, to try and change your attitude. We had a book in our monastery in Perth, in Thailand a long time ago, about how to give birth. And people wondered, what are you doing with that book in a Buddhist monastery full of men? How to give birth. And the reason was that it was a group of hippies, you know, who they were in the summer of love, 1968 in San Francisco. They got a bus and started a commune somewhere, and one good thing they did was revolutionize childbirth. And apparently that book was a standard text in many gynecology classes. They never called it labor pain. Change the name. They called it labor energy. A simple thing like that, don't call it labour pain, labour energy. Call it like huge waves like in the ocean coursing through your body. And don't resist it. Cheer people up. Yeah, go, ride the wave, girl. Go, go, go. And that positive energy which was there alongside a woman in labour had huge effects. The time in labour was really small, and many women giving natural childbirth never felt any pain. They didn't even call it pain. It was energy. Sometimes they joke, this is going to be the biggest shit in your life, they say sometimes. But anything like that, making a bit of fun, taking away the negativity of pain, lessens your relation's pain. But if you react, oh, that's terrible, oh, if you suffer with them, you make their pain worse.
All right, thank you, sir. I'm trying to sort out lots of questions. So the next question is also on family and dealing with their suffering. What should one do when it is apparent that your family member is heading for downfall, which is doing something that regret is inevitable?
Okay, if someone is doing something and they're getting into trouble afterwards, sometimes there's no way you can stop them. It's like a parent who sees their child being hurt. It's very, very painful for you to see your child being hurt, but sometimes you have to let them be hurt. It's the only way they can really learn. And so sometimes even a parent, just because you're in your 60s or 70s, doesn't mean you're beyond learning. Sometimes you have to learn from mistakes. Obviously, if that's your child, you try to protect them from too much pain, but don't protect them totally. You have to sometimes let your parent ruin himself, but not too much, so you can get them back again. Sometimes that's the only way they can learn the lesson. I know there are some parents, their child gets involved with drugs. And honestly, we sometimes tell them, the best thing which would happen to them is if they get caught by the police. Because once they get caught by the police, yeah, it's incredibly painful and shameful, but at least from that time they have to go into rehab. They've got no choice anymore. They can't say that they don't need it. They have to. It's compulsory. So I know some parents, they say, well, it was a really tough time, but the best thing which ever happened to their kid was they get caught by the police. And they realize there's a problem, they have to do something about it. So sometimes even with your parents or your elder relations, sometimes they have to have that downfall. It's the only way they will learn a lesson.
Thank you, Ajahn. Because just now in your talk you mentioned about the story of the duck and the chicken. So sometimes it's not about being right, but being compassionate. But what if you are 100% sure that it is a duck? Wouldn't saying it's a chicken be lying? Aren't there times where you need others to see the painful truth? Isn't that what a loved one sometimes needs to do honestly?
Now this is a good question, because what is the truth? We always think that we know the truth. Again, in this medical school where I gave a talk yesterday, I told the professors of a friend of mine, a GP now, who when he went to Royal Prince Alfred Hospital in Sydney to do his med school, the professor, a quite famous professor of medicine, the head of the medical school, welcomed all the new students. And in his opening address, he said this is his last few months, he's about to retire. And he said, I welcome you to this medical school. 50%, he continued to say, 50% of what we're going to teach you in the next 4 years is wrong. My problem is, I do not know which 50% that is. And that is a scientist. Science is always work in progress. Truth is something we're always finding out anew. Truth is not static. Truth is always dynamic. We always find out new angles, new ways of interpretation. That's why if you think you're right, how many people thought they were right 10 years ago and have found they were terribly wrong? Philosophies, religions, ways of looking at life. Many people thought they were true, but many of you are old enough to know that they were wrong. But they thought they were right. Be careful. If you think you're 100% right, then you're 100% a fool. There is no such thing as 100% in right.
Thank you, Ajahn. So that's an interesting question. Sometimes there is obviously wholesome and unwholesome things, right and wrong, such as being abusive or not. So that's a question which says, how to open the door of your heart to abusive partner? How could you calm someone who has been abused?
Okay, it depends obviously on the level of abuse. If it's going to be a danger for your health, physical health, you have to get out, report it to the police. Domestic violence is a huge issue in our modern world. I'm sure it's a big issue here in Singapore as well. It's unacceptable, it's dangerous. People die because of that. So it's unacceptable, but most cases of domestic abuse, violence, begin with small things. And to open the door of your heart to that, the trick is to open the door of your heart to the part of the other person which isn't abusive. To recognize that part of them. One lady I knew a long time ago, she told me, she came to say thank you one day for saving her life. She said that she was not a Buddhist, she was not interested in meditation, but every hour she was in my center was 1 hour she wasn't being hit by her husband. It was a refuge for her in the days before we had no other means of dealing with domestic abuse. But even though she came to a center just to get away from her very violent husband, she learned something. And what she learned was to look at the other part of her husband and to reinforce that. Every time he did something nasty to her, she ignored it. Every time he was nice to her, she gave him a big hug, lots of kisses. She was reinforcing the good behavior in her husband. Now this was a woman, this is not something I'd recommend for others, but it shows you what's possible. She said it took her 7 years to turn that monster into this beautiful man. And he came to our monastery. He reinforced his good behavior by letting him know how much it was appreciated. She never reinforced his bad behavior because she tried to ignore it. Shouting at her, hitting her, she wouldn't react. He was doing that to try and control her, to try and harm her, to try and upset her. She would not let him do that. Every time he was kind, a decent man, that's what she responded to. And only after, 7 years it took, but that was one incredible woman. She was like a saint. Sometimes I come across people, they're just radiant. She got her marriage. She had 2 beautiful kids as well. She deserved all the happiness she had because she made it in very difficult situations. So please, don't just focus on the abusive behavior. Focus on the other part.
Thank you, Ajahn. There are a couple of questions regarding finding a life partner and inter-religious marriage. So I'll just read one question that summarizes many of them. If we love a person that has different culture, different religion, what should we do? Do we enjoy the present moment or fear of the future or people judging and that our family members won't allow?
Okay, many, many, many years ago, there was a Catholic man married a Thai Buddhist in Perth, where I live. They came to him for advice. What should we do? My husband's a Catholic, he likes going to church. I'm a Buddhist, I'm Thai, I like going to the temple. What should we do? And the advice they gave is, every Saturday, both of you come to the Buddhist temple. Every Sunday, both of you go to church. You're married, do things together. Thai Buddhist wife, learn about your husband's culture. Go there with him. Italian Catholic, learn about your wife's culture. Come to the temple. And that's what they did. And they still keep coming. That was about 20, 25 years ago. A really, really close couple. So that's what you do. If you are a Buddhist, you marry a Muslim, then go to the mosque when they have the service on a Friday. And then when it's a Buddhist ceremony, maybe the Buddhist fellowship on a Sunday, then go to the Sunday service at the Buddhist fellowship. Do things together. Love is all about respecting one another and learning from one another. You know, these days, actually for a long time now, we don't have this interreligious marriage or interracial marriage. For many, many centuries now, we've had intergender marriage. You don't marry people of the same gender. Woman is different than a man. Man is different from a woman. So you learn from one another. You complement one another. Why can't we do that with religion and race? No problem, I think.
All right, thank you, Ajahn. That's a question on meditation, a really simple one, but I think you can give a good answer to that. Why should I meditate, and how do I start?
Why should you meditate? Because meditation is literally food for your heart. You need food for your body, healthy food, so you can have a healthy, good, productive life. If you don't eat well, you'll be very sick and very painful. If you don't meditate, you find your spiritual life will be so hungry, you'll get angry. You will not know that emotional sensitivity to be able to live with another human being. You will never understand your children. Children will never understand their partners. You will have no pathway into the knowledge of the emotional world. Meditation is the pathway so you get to know who you are and how you work inside. So it is fundamental, so important. This was Louis Pascal, a mathematician, a French mathematician and philosopher 300 years ago, who said, all the problems of mankind come from not knowing how to sit still. All the problems come from not knowing how to sit still. That was 300 years ago. Applies even more so today. If our politicians, business people, husbands and wives could learn how to sit still instead of arguing, we'd have a much more peaceful world. Because in that stillness, you will have some reflection. When I was in Hong Kong, I gave a talk at the Foreign Correspondents Club. That's where they said the last person who gave the talk there, the lunchtime talk, was David Cameron. And afterwards was me. And I taught people about how to deal with difficult people. And one of the ways to deal with difficult people is the 30 seconds of silence. After someone has shouted at you, don't talk back yet. Be silent. Give them an opportunity to reflect on what they just said. These days we say give them the space to be mindful of their terrible speech by being silent for 30 seconds. And they really loved that. They said that was what they got out of that talk more than anything else, the 30 seconds of silence. And they never heard that before, I don't know why. But that peacefulness, that ability to be meditate, to be still, not to keep doing stuff, gives everybody an opportunity to reflect and understand life. Okay. And how you do it, go to the Buddhist Fellowship or the Brahma Center or any of these other great places, or go online if you don't like going to a temple.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
Very good.
There's a couple of retreats coming up, so do stay tuned in bodhiana.sg as well as buddhistfellowship.org. All right, so another question on meditation, because meditating can be hard sometimes. So this person asked, I had food poisoning not long ago, and I tried meditating, but the pain got better of me.
Okay, please never meditate with pain. This is not torture. It's so different than going to the dentist. This is not Guantanamo Bay. This is Buddhist. We're compassionate. We're kind. That's why you should meditate on a chair. Meditate on an armchair. Keep it simple. Keep it comfortable. And number two, never try to meditate. Stop trying. Trying is not meditating. That's more doing, more stressing out. Let go of trying. Stop doing so much. If you have thoughts going in and out of your mind, let them be. Stop trying to control them. The whole point of meditation is not being a control freak, but letting go. After a while, you get it. And then meditation was peaceful and happy. Again, I just come back from Hong Kong. You know where I held my meditation retreat in Hong Kong last weekend? In Disneyland. I did my meditation retreat in Disneyland. It was a huge success because it changed people's attitude to meditation. Doing a meditation retreat in a Disneyland hotel. We meditated in the Snow White room. And all interviews which I conducted was in the Prince Charming room. I was Prince Charming. Now, with that attitude change, people had really good meditation. It was a huge success. Because it takes people's this whole concept of meditation is pain, endurance, pushing through stuff. You can't have pain, endurance, and pushing through stuff in Disney World. It just doesn't fit. That was why that was a very, very good retreat. Highly successful, and everybody was asking, when can we do it again?
So there's also another question. Interested to know how long you meditate per day?
You like how long? I usually meditate 24 hours a day. And you know when the best time to meditate is? And the worst time? The best time to meditate is now. The worst time is later.
So maybe we should cut it off now and meditate.
Yeah,
no, just joking. Okay. So a follow-up question is, does recital of Heart Sutra, is recital of Heart Sutra useful?
Is reciting the Heart Sutra useful? It can be to scare away ghosts. It can be to comfort your grandma. Chanting can be useful if you give it meaning. But just chanting is not good enough. For example, I don't know all of you who are driving home, you may have your highway code. Chanting the highway code again and again and again, is that going to help you be a good driver? Up to a point, once you can learn that highway code, you know the rules, that's good enough. Once you know what the Heart Sutra means, you don't need to chant it anymore. But people keep on chanting for years and years and years, and they still don't know what it means. What a waste of time that chanting is.
That's really interesting because there's a question saying that a lot of people mention chanting sutra make will help us in terms of good health, reduce karma. So does it mean that if we don't know the meaning of the chant, we are not really benefiting from it?
Exactly. If you do the chanting, it may be stopping you to do other silly things like going out, getting drunk, and just gambling. And it's certainly, like I said, worse than getting drunk and gambling is gossiping. So if you're chanting, you can't be gossiping, so that's a good thing. So it can have some benefits, but seriously, the power of chanting comes not in the chant you are doing, but in the power of the person who does the chant. So as I said, when I went to that bedside and did the wrong chant, and the person who I was supposed to give a peaceful death to recovered, chanting does have power, because I've got power. I can do that. But if you did the same chant I did, it wouldn't have as much benefit at all. So chanting is a way of taking the energy from the chanter, giving it to somebody else. But it has no intrinsic power in itself.
Thank you, Ajahn. Next question is on Thai black magic. So this fellow member has a close family who recently had been cast black magic on. And then, what is your advice on protecting ourselves from these black magic? And is there a risk of this energy spreading?
I have actually seen black magic. I've tasted it. It was one of my favorite brands of chocolate, which I used to give to my girlfriend. No black magic chocolate? Okay, anyway, let's go back to real black magic. There was, there was one of my disciples in Perth, Australia, a Thai girl. She invited her mother over to live with her because there was no one else to look after her elderly mother in Thailand. Her elderly mother got sick, was put in hospital. And this Thai girl wanted to find out if this would be her mother's last sickness or not. So she went to a medium, gave her $20, and the medium would go into a trance and be able to see whether this woman's mother would survive or not. All the medium needed was the name of the hospital, the ward, and the room number. And then she would leave her body, go to an astral body, go to that ward, and in the astral plane she could tell whether that woman was going to live or die. So the Thai girl handed over the $20, and this lady fell unconscious, and maybe 15 minutes later she came conscious again, and the first thing the medium did was to give the $20 note back to the Thai girl. She said, well, why? Why are you giving the money back? Couldn't you find my mother? She said, yes, I found her. I got to the hospital, I got to the ward, I found the room number, but I could not get inside the room. She said, there was like a force field around your mother in this astral plane. There was a force field, and I couldn't penetrate it. Who the heck is your mum? And the Thai girl said, oh, she is a Thai nun. She's been ordained for the last 30 years. At which the medium snatched the $20 back and said, you should have told me before you asked me to do this. People like me cannot get close to people like that. Now this is an anecdote, a true anecdote, I know the people involved, which actually shows you that if you keep things like precepts, you have actually a force field around you. You can't see that, but the spirits which are employed by black magicians, they know that, they can't get close to you. I have many other stories like that. Even keeping five precepts, being a good person, makes you invulnerable to anything like black magic. They cannot harm you at all. This is just the physics, the science of that mental world. Black magic works on that level. It's on that level of keeping precepts, being a good person. That is what protects you.
Thank you, Ajahn. So on the note of keeping precepts and practicing Dhamma, you know, some people are very rich, their lives are good. So what is the incentive to practice then?
How can you help a person who is very rich but not happy at all? Exactly, it was actually proved in many places by these psychologists. If you don't have enough money, you can't have any happiness at all. Because you haven't got enough money to just pay your bills, it's always a struggle in life to do things, and you don't have any disposable income to go travelling and enjoy your life, go shopping, whatever you like. But people with too much income also suffer. The psychologists have actually seen the more income you have, the more problems and worries you have. You've got to invest it to keep it going, and you have to worry about the stock market. You get financial advisors and planners, and some of those financial advisors are crooks. And you've got to be very careful who you take advice from, where you invest your money, what business you do. And it's a lot of stress. If you look at anyone who's very rich, it's incredible stress. I went to one woman's house who was very rich, a huge mansion, and I asked, how many people live here? She said, only me. A huge mansion, very rich. Why? Because I'm afraid that my friends or relations will come and ask me for money. That's what happens if you're rich. People don't see you, they only see your bank balance. So it becomes very lonely when you become very rich. So because of that, there is an optimum income. Less than that, it's proven you're not happy. More than that, you're not happy. And I think some time ago, I think in Australia it was about $100,000 a year. More than that, you know, your happiness actually goes down. Less than that, your happiness goes down. I think maybe in Singapore it'd probably be more than that. The cost of living is a bit more, probably about a couple of $100,000 a year, your income. More than that, and you'll suffer. So if there are anybody here, is anybody here who is earning over $200,000 a year, I can help you become happy. Please see me afterwards. But it's true. But the reason why you are rich, this is Buddhism, karma. You have worked very hard, you've been very successful, you deserve your wealth, but like wealth karmically is a responsibility for you. You have to make sure you make use of that wealth. And if you just squander your wealth on stupid things, like big jets and on crazy holidays and on properties all over the place which you can't even live in, if you squander the wealth, you will lose it in your next life. Because it's as if this life is testing you. How do you make use of your wealth? But if you use it wisely, looking after your... But please don't give too much to your kids. You have to work hard for your money. If you just give money to your kids, it's just like Paris Hilton. It spoils their whole lives. They have to earn it. They have to struggle. They have to strive, like you did. Don't make their life too easy. I do that with my monks. Make sure that life is not too easy. Otherwise, they will never grow. So, use your wealth wisely. Charities, Buddhist things, Christian things if you're a Christian, hospitals. And that is money very well spent, because at the end of your life you look back on what you've done and it gives you so much happiness. You've had wealth and you've used it very, very wisely. So if you are rich, please don't keep it for too long. Use it. There's many, many organizations, many places which could really, really do with your wealth. Share it about. Very good.
Thank you. One last question. Hi Ajahn Brahm, the most important teaching is letting go. Lots of examples, like putting all negative emotion in a stick and throwing into the sea, or on a toilet paper and flushing it away. What if it does not work still? Letting go is easier said than done.
Again, acoustics, I can't hear what she says up here, because it's no good. The most important teaching is letting go. That's only half the teaching, letting go. The other half of the teaching is, when there's nothing to do, then you let it go. When there's something you need to do, give everything you've got. Or as I often say, if you're on the back of a motorbike in Singapore traffic, do not let go. Hang on. Okay, so you let go of things which should be let go of. As I say, the shit of life. But the good things of life, you keep that. You know the old story of the shit collector and the egg collector? You know, they quickly, two chicken farmers, one goes into the chicken enclosure with the basket, fills the basket full of eggs and brings that back into the home. The other one is a stupid chicken farmer, goes into the enclosure, fills the basket full of chicken shit, the little pellets of chicken dung, and leaves the eggs in the enclosure to rot. He collects the shit, not the eggs. What's the meaning of that story? Ajahn Chah first told me that story, my master. He said, most people, and probably many of you, you're actually shit collectors. Well, it doesn't matter what happened this past week, that's what you remember. All the things which went wrong. The time you got fined, you know, for going through the speed camera. The time you argued with your partner. The problems you've faced in the last few weeks. That is what you remember. You're shit collectors. But the egg collectors, you leave that in the past to rot. What went wrong? The terrible things which happened to you today. The time somebody let you down. You forget that. You collect all the beautiful things which have happened to you today. The lovely conversation you had with a friend at work, the wonderful dinner you had, or the lunch you had, be seeing your kids today, whatever it was which was really beautiful and happy, keep that. And that way, we let go of things which we should be letting go of, and we keep that which we should be keeping. Letting go is only half of life. We should keep the beautiful part, the positive part, the inspirational part of life, and then we will be very happy people. Yeah, life is disappointing sometimes. Yeah, you know, you look at the news and all these things which are going on, but every now and again it's a beautiful news. Keep that and delete all the other stuff.
Thank you so much. So, shall we all put our palms together and say three sadhus for Guru Sherry?
Okay, it's a long time which I've given a talk here in Porkaksi, and many of you know that that is not the way to end the Buddhist talk by Ajahn Brahm. I already said if there's something to do, you've got to give it everything you've got. So if you're going to do three sadhus, everything you've got, please follow me. Sadhu.